A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
You are listening to Missed Apex Podcast. We live F1. Welcome to Missed Apex Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Reddy, but my friends call me Spanners. So, let's be friends. We've dropped in for a little bit of a news roundup. We're obviously looking forward to the Japanese Grand Prix, but we're going to look just a little bit ahead at the Miami Grand Prix as well. I'm joined by Matt Trumpets. Hello, Matt.
Cooler is better.
For who? You can't do cryptic intros. I have to sit here and work it out, and I look stupid for not knowing what you're saying.
No, I'm talking about the race coming up. Yeah, that's absolutely going to be the coolest Japan I think we've had in a while. And that might be good news for Mercedes.
But it's a track where Red Bull traditionally do well. And basically it was Mercedes said, we don't understand much, but we understand that when it's cooler, we have an advantage. As it heats up, we lose it.
Yeah, see, you knew.
Yeah,
you knew
eventually.
Had time, but you knew the whole time. I had faith in you.
No, you're just randomly saying types of temperature and then expressing a preference for them. Took me a while to get there, but I got there. There has been a warning of tsunamis in the area, and that has abated now. But yeah, Japan traditionally has thrown us, you know, some real tumultuous weather.
Yeah, I think they are saying that it's also quite possible that it's going to be wet. And so that's going to be even more exciting because it tends to throw a lot of the confounding factors for the bottom teams up in the air, and you can get some wild results.
Right. So today we're going to introduce you to a new friend, but not before I remind you that we are an independent podcast produced in the podcasting shed with the kind permission of our better halves. We aim to bring you a race review before your Monday morning commute. We might be wrong, but we're first. Okay, so as we have mentioned in the past, we are going to be going to Miami. Me, Matt, Christina, we're trying to persuade Brad as well, but we're going to be doing a live show on Saturday night, which you're invited to. You can check out the details by going to mistapexpodcast.com/Miami. But hosting us there from Boxbox Auto is author, I think that's the way to describe you, is author Andy Amendola. Hello, Andy.
Hello, Spanners and Matt. So excited to be here.
You're graciously hosting us at your sports and social club, which is very brave, maybe foolish of you. But we're going to have a nice mix of your auto members, Missed Apex members, listeners from The Ringer. So it should be a little festival of Formula One in your club.
That's going to be a great, great event. We're all super excited.
That's great. And I saw on the flyer, though, there's a big difference between British culture and American culture. You've put on there a spectacular evening of Formula One, and I'm like, whoa, that's way too much pressure. Some gentle fun around Formula One.
No, it's going to be the event of the weekend.
No, you know, well, there's actually, you know, a Grand Prix there as well. So actually,
oh, no one's gone to that.
See, that's well, as a Miami resident, I think I might start with that. I'm going to show the YouTube channel your books as well.
because they're great. They're kids' books. And as a parent of teenagers, I don't have to do this anymore. But, you know, the endless days reading stories of, well, the rabbit fell down a hole and now the rabbit has lost its family or whatever. This is interesting. I can swap that out for a Formula One book. And basically, we're going to indoctrinate everyone's children into motorsport. So that's what we're going to do. But firstly, before the show, you were saying to me, no one's watching the race, as in the fanfare has dropped away in Miami.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the first year, 22, when we first hosted the race, there was tremendous fanfare. The city was, you know, promoting it weeks, if not months in advance. And everyone was excited. All the teams had events. It was huge. And personally, we have an F1 fan group on WhatsApp, like so many other fans do. And that year we had 80 people in our group go to the race. Mm. Then last year, that number went down to 50 people. And this year we're struggling to get 30 people.
So this is the thing.
Your excitement has declined among kind of the hardcore fan group.
Yeah, I just want to ask, do you think this is more of an F1 in-person problem? Or is this also a Miami-specific thing?
I think it's more about the event itself in Miami and who it's catering to. So what we've seen is that, you know, if you can afford hospitality, it's a fantastic experience. If you're in the paddock, fantastic experience. And really, the organizers are focused on making it really great for that side. But for us, average fans who are going into the grandstands, and they didn't even have general admission tickets in the first year. So, you know, we're in the grandstands, and there's not a ton of love for that type of fan. And I'm comparing this to us. So I've been to the U.S. Grand Prix in Austin, which is a great experience for the average fan as well. So, and when you think about like where the pricing is for the Miami Grand Prix compared to all the other Grand Prix, I think we're the second most expensive after Las Vegas. So, it's a little out of reach for the average kind of, you know, motorsports fan to go to see a race.
Well, that's good news for me and Matt, because we're hoping to get in a little cheaper this year. maybe a lot of your group found out, and that sometimes actually Sunday at the Grand Prix isn't actually as good as watching it on telly. So I love Friday, Saturdays at a Grand Prix, but when it comes to Sunday, you don't know what's going on unless you happen to be at a big screen and have commentary.
Yeah, 100%. And especially, it's a new race, so they're still working out a lot of bugs. We were promised, you know, this huge screen right in front of our section so we could at least follow the race. But the reality is there was no screen that first year. And then the second year where we moved, screens are smaller. So it is really hard to follow the action. And just in talking with all the other people here in Miami that I know that had gone to the race, they're saying the same thing. We'll get tickets for Friday, Saturday, and we'll watch, you know, at a watch party, or we'll watch at home where we can be comfortable, actually follow the race. And what's interesting, in Miami, a lot of races will have a kind of a free radio broadcast, so you can listen onto the commentary. They didn't do that at Miami, which is another kind of letdown for the average fan, because it's a way to keep up with what's going on.
Do you think this is going to be a long-term problem for the event, or do you think it is just so narrowly focused that it's just sort of an afterthought if anybody shows up to fill up the grandstands to them?
Yeah, it feels, you know, ideally it'd be something that would change, because when we all heard that F1 was coming to Miami, we were so excited. We wanted to make this the home, you know, race for many years to come. Obviously, we have a 10-year contract, but what we found out is that they're really not making it for local kind of everyday fans. It's an event to generate money by big ticket hospitality, bring in visitors. Miami is a big, you know, tourism hub, so it's a great place to bring in visitors, but it doesn't feel like, you know, it's made for people from Miami, is what I would say. So I think unless that changes, they're still pretty focused on that hospitality, you know, VIP kind of visitor.
Well, that's what we've got to do, Matt. We've got to make ourselves indispensable VIPs. That's the next stage. But do you know, Miami's a lot more spread out than I thought. Do you notice the effect of F1? So where you are with your social club is sort of between where the track is and Miami Beach, where all the good stuff happens. But do you notice an effect at that weekend?
So I felt it a lot the first year. it was everywhere we went. There was something, and there was a bunch of fan like festivals around it. And it's kind of decreased year by year. And this year I've seen one billboard up so far. So it's not a ton. We'll see when it comes out. But what happens is, because we're spread out, Red Bull will do an activation in one part of town called Wynwood, for example. And then the Williams will do a pop-up in Miami Beach. You know, maybe McLaren will do something else somewhere else. And it is a little spread out. So unless you're moving around the different neighborhoods, you might not catch it all. It doesn't feel all-encompassing. Yeah. It's different than a Las Vegas, where everything takes place, you know, in a small kind of centralized area. All and right. The track is outside of the city, so you have to travel. There's no walking to a track in this scenario.
I'm learning that.
Off the highway.
So I asked Jessica Smetana when she was on about, you work in Miami. So what are the, like, you know, the transit, buses, trams, or whatever? And she laughed and laughed. So we're going to have to rent a car while we're out there. So we'll talk about you guys are hosting us. We want to get people over there. But also, as a complete bonus, I discovered your books, Red Racer books. And I want to share this with the audience. I've got a special cam set up for it and everything. But tell us about these motorsport kids books.
Yeah, so I created Red Racer books because I fell in love with Formula One racing as a later stage fan. I'm 42. I just found out about the sport 5 years ago and fell in love, and I wished I had known about it when I was younger. So, you know, I went to actually look for books for my kids about F1, and I couldn't find any. And in 2021, after going to the US Grand Prix and actually going to my first race in person, I was inspired to create my own books. And it started with one book, The ABCs of Racing, which is a intro to racing for kids. Every letter is a new term. The idea is that you read it with your kids, and then you can watch a race together. And then it went to All About Race Cars, because I'm fascinated by the engineering side of racing and all the STEM. And I think that's an amazing platform to get kids into science and technology and learn about sport in a different way. And from there, I just fell in love with all motorsports. So I'm kind of growing the business, the brand, to be a platform to educate, engage, and inspire kids around motorsports.
It's really, really good idea. I mean, my kids are a little bit old for this, but I could just imagine having sat down and been able to speak to them. Matt, you'll like page 9, and I'm going to post this on my social media as well. But you've got an exploded diagram of a basic single-seater car. And then, you know, you can sit and you can say, well, what does open wheel mean? It means the four wheels are outside the body of the car, unlike the cars you ride around in normally, which have wheels underneath the car. And then I like this one with the passengers, where you can go, it's single seat. It means it is made for a single person to drive. Sorry, no passengers. But that is like really well pitched at like 5 to 7 at bedtime?
Yeah. That the All About Race Cars is a little, you know, probably at 5 to 8, I would say, is kind of the sweet spot. It's for kids who want to understand more about the cars. And there's a lot of like books about this, about monster trucks and things like that. But the science behind a Formula One car is next level. So it's my way of creating like fan nonfiction, basically.
I love it. These are beautiful books. You were kind enough to send them to me. And I do want people to go and check them out. So we'll obviously put a link to them in the show notes. But where should people go? They're searching for Red Racer books?
Yeah, Red Racer books is kind of the catch-all. You can go redracerbooks.com. It's also available on Amazon and in various places. And I, you know, have stock in UK, so it ships pretty quick from my website.
Andy, absolutely fantastic chatting with you. And I think we've painted a pretty negative picture of the Miami Grand Prix, but still come and check out the Mistapex event.
So what I will say is that there are a lot of amazing things that happen around the race. And, you know, the race is an amazing experience, too. I want it to be successful, and I'd love to, you know, keep going for sure. But,
Do you know what Miami lacked, which Las Vegas got? So with Vegas, we looked at that track layout and we go, there's no way this is going to be a good race. And we detailed out, Matt, I don't know if you remember in the preview, I've got to drag it out. We detailed like the 6 things that need to happen for this to be a good race. And they all happened. So Vegas just happened to roll 6 sixes. Miami needs that Baku style race. You know, unfortunately, it needs someone to stick it in a wall and give us a good safety car.
Yes. And I think I know it's only one thing that we need, and it's rain. because in Miami in the summertime, it rains all the time. The last 2 years have been completely dry during the race, which is crazy. So, a little spot of rain.
I'm really torn on this because I've never been to Miami, and also I haven't had any time off for a while. So the rain must stop by the end of Sunday.
Okay. Well, in Miami, the rain only happens very short. It's like it'll rain for like an hour, it'll rain hard, it'll be doom and gloom for 30 minutes, and then after that, it'll be total sunshine. So we just need a little.
So there's a realistic chance of rain at some point ever. Oh, okay, Matt.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, as someone who used to vacation as a child in Florida, what you get is a massive downpour of rain that will evaporate in 45 minutes. And it's for racing. There's nothing.
Perfect.
It could go from red flag restart on wet tires back to dry tires in 25 minutes.
100%.
That's the perfect scenario for rain. So if it rains in Monaco, it sort of stays very wet. And you kind of go, oh, are they ever going to get this thing started? But if you've got that kind of instantly drying conditions, that might be good. But that's what I think. I think there is a bit of bad luck that they had two races where it's been a procession and nothing much has really happened. The track probably doesn't lend itself to a Silverstone-type race. But if you can get that well-timed safety car, if you can get a downpour of rain, then you know you'll see the interest pipe up. And honestly, it's a little bit sad as a British fan. I'm here with two Americans, one DTS American and one olden days F1 American. And I'm desperate. I'm just a Euro F1 fan looking at the American audience, asking you to love us. And when you have disappointing races like Miami has been, there's a genuine sadness because I want you guys to keep loving F1.
We feel the same way.
Okay, and so we'll try and spread that love of F1 at our event. Make sure you go and check out what we're doing by going to mistapexpodcast.com/Miami. If you're going to the Grand Prix, make sure you hang out with us on Saturday night. Andy, thanks for your time, and let's see if we can get some of these books into children's brains to indoctrinate the next generation.
I love it. Thank you, guys. Have a good one. See you in Miami.
Now let's move on to the Big Dirty News.
Big Dirty News.
That is exciting. I am going to go on an aeroplane. I haven't been on an aeroplane since pre-COVID, actually, Matt. It's always you coming over to England for Mist Apex stuff.
This is the first time you've come to visit our shores since the big pandemic thing happened.
It's actually the first time since 2008 was the last time I went to Manhattan. And I've never been to the Hotbits.
And you were in Manhattan. You didn't even say hi to me. Honestly.
I didn't know you. 2007. So Matt has brought to me a platter of F1 news. The biggest thing, I think, from a team point of view, is Sanchez leaving McLaren already. What's going on there?
Well, this is not a nothing burger. Sanchez was a highly touted recruit to slot into McLaren's newly developed engineering structure that's responsible for their big improvement in performance, and he's been there about 2 or 3 months and is noped right out of the deal, saying that what he expected didn't align with the reality on the ground. So this is potentially problematic if they were counting on him, because I believe he's ex-Ferrari, to help them finish taking that step into properly competing with Red Bull and Ferrari and the former Mercedes for the top tier spots.
The former Mercedes. Is that what we're doing now?
Well, I mean, at the moment, could you really say that Mercedes was ahead of McLaren? But it's the idea of where they were that I was talking about.
Yeah. Okay. So, we made those early race predictions and, some of them have been, not quite as good as I'd have hoped those predictions were. But if you roll back, basically we had Ferrari being strong after testing, but not being up there with Red Bull. And I think there's actually probably a little bit more hope than I had pre-season that Ferrari might be able to do something, find something. They're not bringing anything in Japan. Red Bull are.
I think the idea would be that they did better than last year. If I'm Ferrari, I win a couple of races. I make things slightly interesting on occasion. And there's evidence that suggests they might be on that track. For Ferrari, I think this season is already a win. If they can develop and get closer, then it's going to be really powerful evidence, because normally that's where they drop the proverbial ball.
Yes.
And I won't reference the rest of Kyle's comment.
Thanks. Yeah. So we got that is pretty much what everyone thought it would be. If anything, Ferrari actually look a little bit more organized. They look a little bit more together. They look a bit more teamy. Obviously, Carlos Sainz has some, you know, he's lit a fire under his ass, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Telling him he hasn't got a contract. So the other thing is, as much as we told everyone, don't draw conclusions from the first three races. You can't. It flip-flops. You can see seasons turn out very different to how they looked in the first three races. Obviously, we've got sucked down the barrel of drawing wild conclusions. So McLaren, we thought, wouldn't be up with that top two, even though they were confident they were going to come out all guns blazing and be in P2. But they look better than I thought they would. So yes, they haven't reached that insane, lofty kind of proclamation, but it's too late. The sponsor's already signed up.
Well, one of the things that I like about this race, Suzuka, that is coming up for McLaren, is it is a race where they had last year's fully developed car because it was in the fall and it switched positions. So we're going to finally get a really good direct comparison of what progress they may have made over the winter. So I think in a lot of ways, this will be an important benchmark for a lot of teams. A lot of teams are planning to bring improvements, but this is the first racetrack that features the full depth and breadth of corners that you like to see comparison purposes. It's like an early season Barcelona, if you will.
You're talking about Suzuka, right?
I'm talking about Suzuka, which is the race coming up. Sorry if I forgot to mention.
No, that's fine. But yeah, this Red Bull tend to go really well here. And it could be almost like made for Red Bull. So you've got that opening sequence where everything is all about high-speed downforce.
Yeah, well, Red Bull is a bit of an enigma to me this year because we saw them struggle on the Friday in Australia, which was unusual, but features some of the same kind of corners that plagued them in Singapore. And here we are at Suzuka, but we're at a different time of year. So we're looking at not only a real possibility that there might be some wet weather to confound them, but the big thing that I referenced at the top of the show is going to be the temperature. The ambient temps are supposed to be between 15 and 21 C, and that is a lot cooler than we normally see raced at that track. And if I'm someone who's very kind on my tires, cold temperatures may not be my best friend relative to other teams
because they won't fire up.
Yeah. Right. I mean, the good news is it's a track that really is hard on the tires and there's a lot of energy that goes through them, but it could give performance differentials at important parts of the race, say coming out of the pits or on the way into the pits or at the start of the race. If you're on a harder tire, it could be a struggle in the early corners to compete with people who are better at firing them up.
Okay, so you're predicting, well, in that case, wouldn't you also struggle in qualifying?
Qualifying, you have an outlap where you can drive to specific parameters unless you encounter traffic. So less so in qualifying. But in the race, depending upon what the weather is, potentially it could be a problem. I mean, we used to see Mercedes have this problem in the early laps with their tires relative to the other teams. Just getting them into the right window took them longer. But this is all a guessing game because we've really only had three races. And you know, as much as you'd love to take it as a firm data point, Red Bull maybe has a harder time with certain types of corners. Maybe they're struggling more with setup because they've changed their concept. The reality is the simplest explanation is, sometimes people just aren't perfect and there's no evidence that they didn't figure it out.
But it's all high speed, Suzuka. So I'm going to annoy everyone again and say Suzuka is exactly mirrored by my experience in sim racing. So, but from going around there, it's all very short, sharp kind of turning. So that those S's, high downforce S's, and then you need a lot of downforce up the hill, up to Dunlop curve. And then the Degners are like barely slowing down, but you're just throwing the car in. So you really kind of get that front end in. And Spoon as well with that weird camber. So it just feels like the cars who are struggling, like Mercedes seem to be struggling with the rear all the time, I can't see Suzuka being the cure for that.
Yeah, but you do have the two slower speed, the chicane and the hairpin, which is going to really complicate setup. And I believe they're slower than anything we see in Melbourne, for example. Mm. And we know that those slow corners can be a problem.
For
slow,
who?
Sharp corners for Red Bull.
Oh, really?
They had the, just think Singapore. If the corner is like anything you see in Singapore, potentially it's a problem for Red Bull, unless they've developed their way out of it. But for Mercedes, the good news is that it's going to be cool because they seem to still be struggling with the correct amount of cooling for the car. And we might not have been seeing the full extent of their power unit at Mercedes, at least. I think at McLaren, you could argue we were seeing more of it. But it might be across all the Mercedes power units. They haven't really been able to fully extract their potential because of cooling requirements not being correct on the bodywork versus the amount of heat being produced by the power unit.
Okay, so we will circle back to McLaren, but Mercedes is the one, when I was talking about pre-season post-testing predictions, Mercedes is the one that has really not fulfilled, you know, that gap. And I still feel like there's potential somewhere in that car for them to be around where Ferrari are. So they've kind of moved themselves out of the way, which I think has let McLaren be ahead of them. But I think what we're seeing is we're seeing McLaren doing really well with their package, and we're seeing Mercedes not understanding and doing badly with their package, if that makes sense. That's my read at the moment.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think this is confirmed by what James Allison has been saying, which is basically, you know, we still have this unexplained problem with our performance at the rear that we're trying to work out. It doesn't seem to be the same kind of global problem they were struggling with last season, but it's very clear they don't have the car in a place where they want it to be.
So the comments were, okay, when we have looked competitive, it's when it's been cooler. But when it heats up, we're unable to be competitive. So have they just gone so aggressive on the cooling that the second cooling's an issue, what, are they having to turn down the engines?
Well, yeah, this is, it's like a doom loop because of how finely calculated the margins are. If you get extra heat, you have to slow down to dissipate it. Otherwise, it just continues to build up. So you have to very carefully limit how your driver's using that power unit, or else you wind up with just like a runaway cycle. Yeah.
So they're not able to cool the engine without losing performance. So that would be the other option, isn't it? Is that you lose aerodynamic performance to cool the engine.
Right.
So that's why they're so fascinated with what's going on in the Red Bull pods. Because if they found some better cooling solution that is not also aerodynamically not making them suffer, then they can, you know, run their power unit higher.
Yeah. The more heat you can get out of the power unit, the closer to 100%, let's just call it for simplicity's sake, you can run that power unit. The amount of heat you produce limits how hard you can run the power unit. So obviously, the better your cooling, the more you can run the power unit. And at some point, there's a compromise with aerodynamics. And Mercedes just seems to have fundamentally miscalculated, certainly at Saudi Arabia, the amount of cooling they needed versus the amount of cooling they provided.
So that might explain why in some conditions their customer teams are able to run better than they are. Which is,
yes, indeed. Absolutely. Because they won't have been cutting as fine a line, because they're dealing with essentially a store-bought product.
Mm. A good point. Whereas Mercedes almost have an extra confidence that, well, it's our product, so we can understand exactly how to run it. And I've complained about this, about Mercedes for years and years, even when they were dominating.
Well, this is your field. Oh. Tell us about it.
No, I've bored people with this story before. But yeah, but basically, I used to really struggle getting engineers to give up performance for cooling, because I understand just the practical world, and I had to say to these guys, you know, I've blown up so many things like these because of cooling. You know, fires are bad, but they don't listen. So that's an interesting thing, and it persists, it looks like. And Toto Wolff, who wasn't going to be in Japan, is now being all, I'm coming to Japan now because it's all going wrong and we need to understand it. with all the greatest respect to Toto Wolff and his management experience and his business acumen, is he going to be able to help technically? I don't really understand what him being there helps with a fundamental engineering issue, unless he's there to stop them messing around between free practice 2 and free practice 3, which seems to have been happening all season so far.
I don't think it's that. I think if he's thinking he needs to be there, it's a personnel culture management issue. Someone needs to be the final say on something from a larger organizational point of view. Maybe there's once again disagreement about how best to proceed, about what problem needs to be prioritized with the budget that's left. Or, you know, maybe they have things that are in, well, let's just call it a gray zone. And there's disagreement about whether or not to proceed spending money on it if it might be ruled illegal before they can run it on track. There's lots of different reasons why he needs to be there. But if he's originally planning to be there and isn't, it's probably a big thing and may not be a good one.
Honestly, I think there's here's my bet. Obviously, we don't have any inside information. But my bet is that Lewis Hamilton would rather win or bin at the moment. I don't think he's interested in grinding out a brilliant fourth or fifth place. And I think George Russell is. So George Russell is making the best of that package and he's happy to do that. Whereas Hamilton is like, well, if I'm not going to be pushing for the win, let's roll the dice and be happy to finish out of the points. So maybe Toto Wolff is there to stop him doing that. Because honestly, that's the perception from the outside.
No, actually, this is a really good, observation from you that I hadn't thought about. But given that Lewis is leaving, Toto just being there to help manage his expectations and his performance across the weekend. I mean, if I'm Lewis Hamilton, I'm not real happy. You've given me a car that is better suited to my teammate. And, you know, you've made all these lovely promises across the winter about it. And then the reality of this car is not delivering in a way that's usable. And he's already going to be feeling on the outs anyway, because once you announce you're leaving, they generally stop including you in a certain percentage of the meeting. So they don't want you taking the technology to your next team. So he's got to feel even more of an outsider now in the team. And the fact that he's unable to be competitive with Russell, or competitive the level he would be happy with Russell. I think if it's a close fight and Russell wins, I think he's going to be fair enough. But he's nowhere near Russell, especially in qualifying. That is kind of a big issue from a personnel point of view.
I think there's no way that he wanted that story to leak. For the reasons you're saying, it's so awkward having a whole year where you know you're on the way out from the very beginning. So that was a leak. So they've obviously had to then get a grip, own the story.
It's the classic sitcom of, I broke up with my partner, but the lease isn't up for a year, so we have to live together for a year.
We'll draw a line down the middle of the apartment that you stay on your side of the line, I'll stay on my side. Yeah, it is awkward because he would have chosen some moment mid-season, and by then they would already have known whether they're competitive. If the season is fizzling out in the way it looks to be set to fizzle out, there would have been no real harm. And I think everyone would have understood. Because it's a weird thing with Mercedes. They were so used to winning. And then they had the awkward 2022 where it's going really badly. But everyone has a target on their back. We're going to claw it back. We're going to do this. And then 2023, it doesn't. But 2024, we've definitely got it this time. It's like an online game lobby where you start winning with a group and then suddenly the victories fall away. And then it's a bit embarrassing and everyone goes, oh, actually, my mum's calling me for a bit of tea. Oh, I'm tired, guys. I'm going to stop playing now. There comes a point where you can't just keep investing and you're never going to hit that same high from the championship. So like the relationship is just, it's done. It's a natural ending anyway, but it would have been a lot less awkward if this had been an August announcement and not a preseason one.
Yeah. And you'd have to think that was what the original intention was, post summer break to make this public. But reality is reality. They're going to have to deal with it. And it's going to be problematic for them because I think they're like, what, fifth or sixth now in the championship standings. It's going to be problematic for them if they don't sort Lewis out and get him closer to George.
I read a headline somewhere that said, you know, is this, we talked about it a while back, but is this the start of a Williams / McLaren style decline? And then I saw a website with that as the headline shortly after we discussed it. I'm torn. One comment that resurfaced from Horner about Toto Wolff has been ringing around and rattling around in my head, which is that he inherited that team in a way. And so Horner's obviously saying, well, I built the team, but Wolff hasn't built anything. And I was thinking, oh, that's unfair. But is it unfair? He did kind of, I mean, he was involved in Williams as a shareholder, but he wasn't in a management role there. Then he came into Mercedes as a triumvirate, wasn't there? There was Paddy Lowe, Ross Brawn, and Toto Wolff. And at that time, everyone was focusing on it being a Ross Brawn team.
Yeah, correctly, I think. Because that's the whole origin story of this team is Brawn. Bought for a pound, sold for a whole lot to Mercedes. But essentially as a team that had just won a championship. And then a few seasons in the wilderness as Mercedes fully took over. But Toto came on board as the business personnel finance guy of that triumvirate. Ross was the engineering guy. And what's interesting about what we're seeing now is I'll just point you like at the Haas announcement where they ditched Steiner, not so much an engineer anymore. I think he was once upon a time. And said, we're just going to promote Komatsu because, look, we got Andrea Stella over at McLaren. All the teams that are doing well are tending to have engineer team principals. And I, Zach Brown, or whoever will sit above that. But my job won't be making these decisions about what technology is going to make this car go faster because we are beyond the point of someone like me being able to make those choices. On a performance basis, maybe on a finance basis, different story. But you see what I'm saying here.
But I don't know how much of how good the car is driven by Toto Wolff, I guess. Horner or by Zach Brown. I don't imagine that Zach Brown is doing an awful lot in the design department.
But he freely admits it. And this is what Komatsu, this is what we see with Stella. Even at Red Bull, I mean, people talk about Newey, but it's also Pierre Waché, I think is how you pronounce it, is really the driving force behind how the car does. If you're Horner or you're Toto, you're making driver decisions, maybe budget decisions. Maybe they come to you and say, we have to make a choice here. This is what this looks like. This is what that looks like. We think from a technical point of view, there's not a lot between them. But from a team point of view, there will be these differences. Like I imagine there are things that they decide, but they're not sitting there going like, yeah, you know, I don't like the drag coefficient on this particular brake duct very much because I don't think the cooling is going to be sufficient. We're going to overheat the tires. Yeah. But those are the decisions that win and lose races when you're talking about car design.
Yeah, but they might get involved with things like driver management and jumping on the team radio.
Sponsorships, like where the bigger money from the team comes
stopping from. Stopping squabbles, because this time last year it was Hamilton and Russell, and Russell was doing his whole, are we fighting or are we working together or what, guys?
Oh, gosh.
Until it didn't suit him anymore. That was so silly.
I know people like George, but man, things like that, just, that's me.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
When we talk about technical people like Sanchez, what was his role? Because I remember you getting excited about it and he had a long gardening leave at Ferrari And then, I guess, does he have to do gardening leave again if he wants to work anywhere?
I would imagine. He's only been there 3 months, though. So I would imagine it would depend on the contract he signed. Like, I don't even know how he can walk away from it. But clearly, if he's leaving, I think there has to be sort of a both sides to this. I think whatever he thought he was getting and what his actual role was or power within the organization, I want to say vehicle design, vehicle dynamics, something like that was his specialty. But honestly, I didn't pay that close of attention to it when I was putting these notes together. So I'd have to go back and check and be sure.
Yeah.
But you'd think that it wouldn't be as long a gardening leave because he's just not been there very long. But the question
long enough to stuff PDFs in his laptop case.
Yeah, maybe. But the question really is, where does someone of his caliber wind up going? Because there's probably a couple of teams that might like to have him.
I want more to the story, though. Alpine are on a mass recruitment, aren't they, at the minute?
Alpine, all the A's, Alpine and Aston, both might very much like to get hold of him.
It's just quite a senior appointment to go wrong so quickly. That's the worrying thing about it.
Yeah, well, it does. I mean, it raises questions about sort of what McLaren's engineering structure really is. On the other hand, they have a successful and one of the more successful cars, relatively speaking, right now. So you can only question it so much. At the end of the day, he clearly wanted something they thought was going to upset the apple cart. And so it was easier for them to keep what they had structure-wise than give him what he needed, he felt, to do the job he was hired to do.
Yeah, it's probably as simple as just, the bases are covered a bit more than he thought. So you go in and you go, oh, my role is a bit more limited than I thought it was going to be. All right. Yeah. Okay, so you had also in our show notes, Sainz and Verstappen. Well, you've written Sainz and Verstappen sitting in a tree. By the way, just so you know, a bit inside baseball, Matt's headlines to the stories are always like a joke or incredibly immature or completely unreadable out. And I have to sit there and adapt, first laugh at it and then adapt it to a serious intro. So Mark Hughes has commented on Sainz and Verstappen, apparently.
Yeah, well, this is part of the larger story of what's happening at Red Bull in terms of the power struggle we're sort of sensing from the outside between the Verstappens and Marco and the Mateschitz side and the Horner and the Uvidia Red Bull overall corporate side. And it goes all the way back to Toro Rosso, where you will recall we had Carlos Sainz competing against Verstappen when he was first promoted. And in general, the thought was that Verstappen slightly got the better of that battle. But something that came out that maybe I knew about and had forgotten and was reminded of was that there was a massive inter-driver conflict and power conflict within the Toro Rosso team. And as Hughes tells the story, essentially, Verstappen got sent out late for a run, didn't do well, didn't have a second chance. Jos was very unhappy with this, went to Franz, and Franz said, we have a run plan for the whole team. And the drivers take turns, whatever it was. Jos went to Marco. Marco said to the race, his side of the garage, do whatever you need to do. I'll take care of it. So the next time this happens, they just sent him out. It ruined the team run plan. Toast fired two engineers for it. Marco got them new jobs. But from that moment on, the power dynamic within the Toro Rosso team shifted and was Verstappen-centric. And so he basically puts it in terms of this is something that has happened at Red Bull. So I was thinking, like, we give Ricciardo a lot of stick, and we may well later in the show if there's time, but we give him a lot of stick for jumping from Red Bull.
Yeah.
I think he would be very well of what I call now the Verstappen distortion field in terms of the power dynamics within a team, where the team gets distorted and pulled to the Verstappen, the whole team. Not just his side of the garage, the whole team gets distorted and pulled to the Verstappen side because that's where the power is. And so his decision to jump was very highly, motivated by dollar signs, certainly, but also a realization that, there would be no competing with that no matter how good a driver he was. And Red Bull's run like that always, Vettel and Weber. I mean, we can always sort of see the number one, number two driver, but I think in Verstappen, you have a concentrated perhaps, example of this. This is kind of Hughes' thesis. And then that does raise the question is if Verstappen does go and Sainz comes in, how much of Verstappen's performance is due to his immense talent and genius, and how much of it is having an entire team to support him? And Hughes thinks Sainz would do a good enough job to keep that car where it is now. But it raises a lot of interesting questions.
Which car?
The Red Bull. Because we're talking about Verstappen going and Sainz coming in. That's the thing, because this is part of the power struggle. Because now you've got Horner on one side with what looks like the upper hand.
Yes.
Corporate power-wise. And you've got the Verstappens on the other side, now with potentially places to go. You get Mercedes, Aston with a new engine in 26, potentially seeing how they do. And, you know, there's always Ferrari when Lewis leaves.
There's a few things here. So really, really good insight there. So, full credit, obviously, to Mark Hughes for breaking that down. And we can quote other people because we were quoted in the newspapers, weren't we?
That's true.
In a British newspaper. Which one was it? It wasn't the Mirror. It was the Express.
I think it was the Express.
Yeah. So they did a whole thing where they based a news story around a comment Brad made in Ultimate Grid saying that, for me, Perez doesn't make the top 20 best drivers. And they even linked to Miss Apex and everything. So you never know who's listening, Matt.
Oh, no. I'm looking forward to the comment. Hence my qualifiers of exactly. I mean, there's no denying how talented Verstappen is. But I think there's also no denying that he's had this distortive effect on where the resource of the full Red Bull team goes.
So make sure next time quote something that I say. So you can say Spanners from Miss Apex, because I'm the best one. That'll get the most clicks. But I will say thank you, because they don't always do a link back to the content source, but it actually was like a clickable link directly to our homepage. And I then panicked and realized that that show wasn't on our homepage. So I had to quickly go and change that. So firstly, things first, well done, Verstappens, because that's a massive advantage. So, you know, we can start talking about Verstappen now in the same realms as the Hamiltons and the Schumachers. I think that's entirely fair.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it.
Yeah.
You know, however he got there, he's absolutely there. And with anything that's like a competitive car, we'll be fighting for the absolute race win every time.
And if you look at what Schumacher did, that team was all about Schumacher. It had to be about Schumacher. So I think the great drivers have always done that. And Jos Verstappen knew that. So Jos Verstappen was driving, you know, in that Mercedes, in that Schumacher dominance. So that's a smart play, and that's a smart thing to do. And at Red Bull, you go, well, they had clearly done that at Red Bull. Ricardo, I think, was upset that they took Verstappen's side in that incident at Baku. So when Verstappen just moved in front of him, basically, and took away his aero, Ricardo unable to brake. I think he was the car behind.
I'm not even sure it matters that much. I think it was just clear to him by the end of the season where this was headed. Max came into the team as the vaunted junior driver. Max was always going to be the focus of the team, no matter how good a job Ricardo did. And he's the only teammate Max has had at the Red Bull level to be like anywhere close to him on any occasion, you could say Perez won those few races, but as a larger, if you're looking at the overall context and picture, not just a race win here or a race win there.
Mm. So Verstappen doesn't have the favor now of the senior management, though. So I'm really, really fascinated to see how the rest of the season plays out. I've said it a few times now, but if we're crediting part of his success, he's clearly an incredible driver, but part of the extreme domination he's had over teammates. So he made Albon, he made Gasly, he's made Perez look like absolute mugs. He has. He's made them look like that. And then when they've been in other teams, those drivers haven't looked like that. They haven't looked like someone who is, a whole qualifying phase behind their teammates. So clearly part of that gap is down to Verstappen having a bit of power in that team. And that power may well have gone now. So, when you've got conflicts, Jos seems to be the person making it happen. And Jos and Christian seem to have some kind of conflict over a thing.
Yeah,
We don't know what it is. I don't know the most. So I really don't know what the conflict that is currently happening or may not be happening between Jos Verstappen and Christian Horner on a personal level is or isn't. But if that dynamic shifts, it would be fascinating to see, because I would love to see that. I would, if the gap starts to close between Verstappen and Perez, I'm going to have a field day with it.
Yeah, and I think everybody's going to have a field day with Brad too. To me, this story ultimately comes down to which side is willing to cut the most of its nose off its face. I mean, on the one side, you've got Horner going full Frank Williams and saying, it's the car, not the driver. You want to leave Max? Bye-bye. We'll find somebody else. And on the other side, you have arguably the most talented generational driver in Verstappen saying, you know what? We don't need this level of agita. We're going to go find another team, and good luck getting this thing across the finish line anywhere close to where I'm putting it. And the answer to that question is just like, oh,
it's so fascinating.
It's so intriguing. I want it to happen now just to see.
Yeah. You know, who I'm a fan of aside, that would be one of the most fantastic and fascinating evolutions in the F1 story. So Verstappen is going to go to most teams on the grid and make them better. Nearly every team right now, he'll go and he'll make that team that better. But so if Sainz and he were to both go to Mercedes, so Verstappen, Sainz at Mercedes, you would go, well, Verstappen's going to win that. But I think if they do that at Red Bull, Verstappen would make Sainz look stupid in the same way that Perez, Albon, Gasly, they've looked stupid. Not stupid's the wrong word, but they've looked utterly outclassed. And I think any driver going to Red Bull against Verstappen would have that.
I would agree with you, were it not for Sainz's history at every other team, including Ferrari, where you expected to see a much bigger gap between him and Leclerc, and it just has more or less failed to materialize. There are clearly things Leclerc is better at. He's got more pace. But if you look at the end result, when the cars cross the line, Sainz has been there or thereabouts all of his seasons at Ferrari. Nobody expected it. So the one thing we know about Sainz is he can think his way out of a problem and into a result.
Maybe.
Like
smart.
Few other drivers.
I don't know. I still feel like that the fact that he's able to kind of be there or thereabouts on the points is down to Leclerc having moments, having incidents, dropping the ball, going missing on the odd weekend. If you took, what do you want? Do you want to just look at the score sheet at the end of the year? Or do you want to go, okay, like in golf, to get your handicap, take the best 10 races of a season from Leclerc and take the 10 best races from Carlos Sainz and match them up, then Leclerc's going to be your pick of a driver. And I know that practically that doesn't help between the two of them, but it does help us when you go, okay, now put Sainz against Verstappen at Red Bull. Because you know, Verstappen isn't going to do the Leclerc going missing on various weekends. He isn't going to be doing the sticking it in the wall on a Friday practice. So Sainz isn't going to be able to just wait for Verstappen to fall down to take advantage.
But Sainz will be winning every race that Verstappen has a problem in. That's what I'm saying. And in fact, that's what happened at Australia, and with Sainz in a different car at a weekend where Leclerc could not get the car to work to his satisfaction. And that's why I come back to Sainz and his ability to think his way. You put Sainz in that car, he'll understand where he lacks compared to Verstappen. But unlike a lot of other drivers, he will be able to change what he is doing. He will be able to adapt and get closer. And he will keep at it till he is so close that if anything goes wrong for Max, he's going to be the one right there to take advantage of it. And that's the difference I see in terms of the quality of him as a driver versus Ricciardo or Perez or anyone else that Max has been up against in the senior team.
I was so sad that Perez didn't manage to get the win on Sunday, because you know, if that happened at Saudi or at Bahrain, Perez was in the position to do it. And he was on a charge as well. The pace looked good. And then he got past Alonso and it just stopped. I was gutted, because that would have just been a lovely joy. As a Perez fan, I've put up with a lot over the last few years. And it would have been nice to have that one spike to go, see, this one race proves everything else wrong.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if it makes you feel better, they did say that he picked up floor damage around the time he passed Alonso, and he had the penalty to cope with, which I don't think was entirely his own fault. I can't remember what it was for, but it was
crossing the pit lane line. something like that.
Maybe, or you know, maybe he blocks somebody. I don't know. I felt like the team was partially responsible for him. It wasn't just a fully Perez.
Yeah, and it's always that way. It's an FP1 moment then affects the grid. You kind of go, oh, yeah. That wasn't even anything to do with the race. But yeah, I was sad with that. Anyway, I am so fascinated to see what is going to happen at Suzuka. Verstappen's probably going to go there, lay down the hammer, and destroy everyone by 50 seconds. But it's the hope is there. So it's the moment before we've bought the lottery ticket, Matt. I think we have good numbers. We've got good numbers on this ticket, and we can hope until the draw comes out on Sunday.
Yeah. Well, I mean, again, there are things about this race and things about the Red Bull team this year that at least let you leave the door slightly open.
For competition. I'm not hoping for... So it's bad form to hope for a mishap to the opposition.
Oh, no, not a mishap. I mean, just full on Red Bull struggling to get the car in the window. Not because think about last season. They showed up to every race except Singapore, absolutely dialed in Friday morning, except for the races that were on Saturday. And then the equivalent of Friday morning. They started with a car Singapore. That almost worked perfectly, and then they just made it incrementally better. And when they showed up to Melbourne, they did not have a car that worked the whole of the Friday, and they had to work really hard to try and get it into line for Saturday. And if Sainz hadn't made a mistake in his qualifying, he might have actually had pole been less than a tenth off. I mean, it was really quite close, closer in qualifying than the final results said.
So you think we'll get a read on Friday?
And I think we'll get a good idea on Friday of whether Red Bull and Engineering More Performance has tightened the window for its setup or not, because this is a Barcelona-like track that has all three different types of corners in enough abundance, and it's particularly brutal on the tires. And cold temperatures, you've seen how sensitive other teams are to just small swings, 5C, and suddenly a team that was nowhere in qualifying is like kicking it in the race.
Two-stop?
I don't know. I didn't look at last year's race, but I usually use last year's race as a gauge. You tend to think so.
Because it's either high load corners. So, you know, the front, that turn one, heavy on the fronts, and then it's high load all the way through the S's. And then you've got a couple of low speed traction zones as well. I don't think you go as far as saying it's rear limited, but.
It's hard to tell. When you look at the Pirelli diagram, all the tires are red.
Right.
For lateral energy.
Yeah.
And the back ones are red for lateral and longitudinal energy, which means going forward and going sideways. Mm. So it looks like a rear limited race, but sometimes in the races, it winds up not being that way.
All right. Okay. Well, let's look forward to that. Nice little, nice. Because I wanted to speak to you because you missed out on Sunday because we had Uncle Joe for a Sunday show. He caused me all sorts of bother. So a lot of people asked me why did I beep out certain things? And it wasn't a liable thing. It was just a little bit PG plus, I think. 12A. It was a 12A advisory. So... if you are in any of the, I think I put on Twitter what he said. So it was just a little bit naughty, Uncle Joe. But some really good insight there, and fascinating that Antonelli, you know, might be an early, you know, a mid-season swap.
Yeah, it does Monza. Seem to be gaining a little bit of traction. So
yeah, because of Joe. Joe's the one saying that to everyone. But basically, as soon as he turns 18, he's got all his super license points. Logan Sargeant's not really doing anything at all to show that he should be there. And it's perfect. If you were going to bring Antonelli into Mercedes, the more I think about it, you go, basically at the back end of the year, last third of the year, get him up to speed, and then he's got full testing, and then he's up and running for 25.
Yeah. Again, it gets back to in this formula, in this age, the cars are so complicated. There's not, F2 is more than a step to F1. It's a real proper leap, and getting your talented driver into a team to just get settled is the smartest thing you can do.
It's just an extended, so it'll be a third of a season long FP1 session for Antonelli, basically. There's potential for upsets there. So obviously he's got Albon as a benchmark, who people think is decent. So he's going to have to, by the end of the season, he's going to have to have, you know, be decent to be anywhere in front of Albon. But also Albon does not want to be getting beaten towards the end of the season. by the new superstar rookie kid, because in his head, he's the superstar kid.
Yeah. No, it'll be a fascinating battle between Albon, who's a pretty good driver and knows the team very well, and Antonelli, who will probably be insanely fast and highly competitive, but also highly inexperienced.
All right, let's get out of here, everybody. So we will see you at about 9:30 a.m. UK time for the Japanese Grand Prix race review. We've got Kyle, we've got Jono. It's going to be the middle of the night for Matt, so we're not going to have Matt staying up until, like, when would our race? It was like 5 in the morning for you.
I think that's it's like 4 or 5. I'll stay up and watch the race and help with the notes and stuff.
Yeah, but, thank you. No, unnecessary to have. We don't want a delirious Matt there. But we are going to catch up and do a mailbag or something during the week. But wherever we see you next. Oh, wait. If you're going to Miami, mistapexpodcast.com/Miami. And you can see all the details there. Basically, 7 p.m. on the Saturday night. Come and hang out with us. We'll do some games. We'll do some live podcasts. And we will show a classic F1 race afterwards. Well, we have cocktails. Wherever we see you next, work hard, be kind, and have fun. This was Missed Apex Podcast.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.